Dr. Brian, welcome to the Man in Kansas podcast. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hence the name of the podcast. I guess you could infer I am bipolar. That is something that is fairly new to me dealing with. I was diagnosed when I was 24. I'm 29 now, and I struggle with addiction issues
Okay.
as well. And I don't shy away from that on the podcast at all. I talk about my struggles. I talk about the type of substances I'm addicted to. I'm highly functional right now, I would say. So I just wanted to give you a background of like me and like where the podcast it's a mental health podcast
Okay.
through and through. So can you kind of tell us like your background, your education, and what you do?
Yes, for sure. Well, I'm a licensed psychologist. I practice out of California. I have my PhD, and currently my clinical work is 100% telehealth. I work contracted with various entities, whether it be hospitals, outpatient clinics across California. I'm also in private
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
practice. And I do have a specialization in insomnia. I work a lot with substance use disorder and now family crisis intervention, where I help coach families to get their loved one to a point where hopefully they can accept help. And in addition to my clinical practice, I also am part of several support groups out there and facilitating groups for family members who need that extra support, along with things like this. I'm very passionate about spreading mental health awareness, and so podcasts, authoring articles and so forth are things I'm really passionate about, and really getting that reach out to other to the communities.
Awesome, Dr. Brian. Well, thank you so much for being a psychiatrist and an advocate for the community.
Psychologist.
A psychologist, I'm sorry, an advocate for the community. For people like you, I'm able to live a normal life, so I really appreciate it. Insomnia, huh?
Sure,
That's
yeah.
that I don't know what type of bipolar it is, but I'm the one where I can stay up all night. And I can, I mean, for days without any effort. But I wanted to talk to you about addiction and its treatment, and first of all, understanding the disease as a disease. Do you agree with the notion that, well, I don't know if it's a notion or if it's fact, but what's your stance on addiction being a disease?
Well, that is definitely just to back up a little bit with that too, is because that question comes up a lot, or sometimes people are looking for clarification on it. And actually, in the medical arena, there's not a unifying definition of a disease. There really isn't, and even in this arena of mental health. And so, some entities or organization will define it as some entity that has symptomologies that are problematic. To there's a whole range of definitions. One institution or organization looks at a disease as not as the presence of an illness, but it looks at health. And so my point being is, for your listeners out there, that the definition of a disease isn't mainstream, and people have different ideas of what that constitutes. But the way that I like to communicate the definition of disease to people I work with is more on a general level. I believe, of course, there are medical diseases. Diabetes, Crohn's, autoimmune are all diseases in the mental health arena. Diseases such as depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, or bipolarity are also seen as another version of disease. But the way I like to communicate this to family members or people I work with client-wise is, a disease is any entity that's been chronic, meaning long-lasting in someone's life, and has caused impairment in multiple areas in their life. And so, with that said, it doesn't necessarily have to be a medical or mental health condition per se. It could be something like selfishness. It could be a disease if it causes impairment in your life. Materialism could be your version of a disease if that causes impairment in your life. Racism could be someone. So that's my point, and is that that means that we all have our own version of our own disease or diseases, and I believe therefore that we're on some form of recovery, which is just a better way of healthier living. So that's at least how I help communicate that concept to someone, because no matter what you put your name on it, I'm not really concerned about the name label, for example. And by the way, I really appreciate your transparency and about your substance and your bipolar and your recovery journey, is because it's really helping a lot of people out there, with people like yourself who are open to being vulnerable and talking about things. It really helps people to the point of actually saving lives, because you're giving people out there permission to be comfortable and to come forth in a way where they don't feel like they're going to be judged. And so your podcast really provides a forum for that. So I really want to really appreciate that as well.
Thank you, Dr. Byrne.
Yeah. And so that's where a disease is, where how it plays. And so like I said, it doesn't matter what you call your disease, what label, it's the symptoms. Right? If you have social anxiety, it doesn't matter. It's social anxiety. But if you have difficulty going in public places, let's work with that. And so it doesn't matter what the name of it is, it's the symptoms and how we can work in improving that.
Thanks for clearing up the definition of disease in, more of a practical way.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. What are some of the common misconceptions about addiction as a disease, and how can we address them?
Good question as well. Is again, addiction, when we define things, and that's what I do a lot, is I find a lot of family members who have these. One of the things I always say, and is recurring, is if I have like 10 people in a room and I ask them to define anxiety, they're going to all have probably 10 different, in some form or fashion, definitions of anxiety.
Some people, in my experience, as just being the addict in the family, we're seen as like, how do I say this without sounding so bad? There's a few of us that grew up addicts and a few of us that didn't. Like, what makes an addict an addict? Like, I know we're talking about definitions here, but like, what is it, a character flaw that is a disease, or is it behavioral?
And
Or is it both?
again, and some people will call it that as well. I don't look at it as a character flaw. And addiction, I think the way I approach it is some that we engage in, that are we still engage them even though we know that they are harmful. But it's
Yeah,
difficulty.
so habitual behaviors that we know are harmful.
But we it's a difficulty hard doing it. We go at significant lengths to be able to engage in that behavior, and it's something that we've become very dependent on. And so that's where I look at least an addiction is. And so where does that come from? I believe it's a variety of things. Sometimes there could be a genetic predisposition to it. If there's a strong family history of addiction, there's a risk factor for that. I do believe also environmental issues, whether it be the culture you're raised and the messages you got. I also believe there's other components, right? Addiction to me, many times, if not most of the times when I work with people, is that they become addicted to a substance as a way to cope with some type of stress or stressors in their life.
Or trauma.
And with definitely with trauma, and the reason why addiction to substances is so attractive is because I talk about it, because it works. It works for what it was originally intended, but over time, as you become more tolerant, it alters brain chemistry, behaviors, and it becomes counterproductive and dysfunctional. And so that's one of the things I tell people, and people are really surprised when I work with families in recovery and treatment or the clients themselves. I said, "Do you know the reason why you use meth or alcohol or marijuana?" And I go, "Sim three simple words, because it works." And so they're like, "You know what? Yeah, it does."
Is that what you would say to people who don't believe marijuana can be addictive? You say it's addictive because it works.
Well, it works for why you are drawn to it to begin. So even if someone is addicted or not, I'll ask them, then why do you turn to marijuana? Well, it relaxes me. It works, right? Or it takes the edge off, or it makes me go to sleep. It works. And that's what's so attractive about it is that because it's readily available, it's accessible, and it works. It works, especially in the very upfront. And what happens, though, is when we latch onto something that works, we tend to ignore or not work on other also ways to help find relief. And we get stuck in this one thing. It becomes that one thing. And we believe it's that only thing that's going to get us to that place that we're trying to do or give us that sense of relief. And that's where a dependence or an addiction comes into play. And then there's also really truly physiological and neurological changes that takes place with chronic use of a substance, right?
Yeah, I think I've definitely gotten to that point. I've seen it in other family members that we've reached a point in our addiction where it's no longer fun. It's more like a chore instead of a ritual that I enjoy. You know, waking up in the morning and like that being the first thing you wanted is not so fun after year three. And it is to the point where it's physiological. I want to stop. I can't stop. Because when I stop, then the withdrawals come. And then with me, I start crying and I start, you know, just being very like symptomatic, like almost an immediate mania immediately. Very almost like a crisis. I've definitely been there where my mother had petitioned me to the state for court order treatment. So I'm considered SMI under the state of Arizona. So dealing with that label is very hard because I feel naked. Like I feel like everyone, I feel like the cops know about it. Every time I get pulled over, if they want to run my if they just want to run my any for my ID for anything, and it's just very hard. Like, so is that when you talk about your new work with crisis intervention, how do you talk to families who are freaking out, who don't know, who are like my family, who are very cultural, very old school, they don't know much about psychology, don't really want to know much about psychology, and don't really respect the practice because they're very old school where they rather see like spirituality to take care of the addiction instead of medicine. Does that make sense? Okay.
And well, it's tough, right? And that's where education, I believe education is the first line of defense. And for example, your family is, I would hope that on some level where there can be a conversation where there's education. And that's where sometimes where we tend to stray away from or fear things we don't understand, right? And
Yes.
so and so that's what can happen sometimes. And there has to be some level of openness. And there has to be a level of humility where when I ask families when they come in and they're very set on certain ways or what this is what we need to do, I mean, a very simple question to put a halt to that level of argumentativeness is, how has your way been working so far? It's a really, really humbling question. Like, where someone's
Yeah.
struggling, well, you know what? I don't really need sobriety. I think I can manage my alcohol, or I can really smoke my marijuana because heroin was my issue. And you hear that language and that narrative. And I simply asked them, I said, well, how has your way been working so far? And I don't think I've ever heard someone say it's been working great, And so that's one thing I ask families is, but to also I would work with that family and meet them where they're at because I want the families on some level at the end of it all to be the expert. So I would integrate, understand your family's perspective on their spirituality and why it's so important to them rather than saying, well, no, psychology, there's a lot of research that shows that this and that, and then challenge their spiritual beliefs and put them on the hot spot. No, I wouldn't do that. I would say, well, help me understand what is it about your spiritual and cultural beliefs that are the strengths of it. And let's see if we can integrate that and maybe provide
Awesome.
an argument. But that's one thing we don't want to do, I don't want to do, is you ought to come meet them from where they're at. And judgment and making assumptions is one way to really move away from creating rapport with someone.
So when you're creating a treatment plan, do you involve the whole family?
It depends. Ideally, it all depends on the situation, but I could say this, for the most part, the support system, it could be one person, it could be a spouse, it could be parents, but having some type of support system, which we call fellowship, is critically important for success. People, especially in this and in general in life, is our level of success. We don't do it on our own. And mental health and substance use issues are no exception. So a fellowship of people to surround yourself, to hold you accountable, to provide that level of intimate care is critically important. So I would say in the almost 15 years of working in recovery, I would say I can count on my hand with the hundreds of clients that came in that you get usually an adult who probably has their own financial care and they're going to treatment all by themselves. Nobody comes for their family because they don't want anybody. You get that literally, I could probably say in 15 years, that was probably like three people. Most of the people need that support system. And those people who choose to not have anybody support them, they usually struggle with long-term success.
So, how do you feel about the phrase relapse is a part of recovery?
Okay. Well, great question. I talk about that. And actually, I differentiate between a relapse and a lapse. And
Okay.
I'm not sure if you ever heard of that.
I haven't. I've been to rehab. It's been 12 years. But that's what I heard in rehab.
Well, it can be. And so does that mean I don't want to normalize it that, oh, you relapsed. That's completely, I
Was
don't want
definitely
to.
normalized. It's like, it's okay. It's part of recovery. And I'm like, oh,
And
okay.
we have to be careful of that. That comes meaningly well. And that's a lot of what I do is what I write in my book, is a lot of these clarifications that I talked about earlier. But so I do differentiate, and these aren't my own words. I actually heard it somewhere along my recovery journey as well, of working in recovery, about the difference between a relapse and a lapse. And so what I talk about it is I believe the strength of someone's recovery program. And like I said before, when all in some recovery, I do believe that there are certain attributes that are very consistent that differentiate someone who's successful and not successful, or just are progressing in the direction of where they want it to head. And but recovery and the difference between a relapse and someone's strength of recovery is usually if someone has a weak recovery program, they're going to relapse. A big fall is because a recovery program, what is that entail? Support, things like honesty, fellowship, I'm having purpose, seeking help, being open to direction, all these attributes. And if someone has a weak recovery program, a relapse is without anything. I'm not getting any support, I'm not working on myself, is that they make these major dip falls. And that's a relapse, is that it's these major falls. And to climb back up, it's very difficult because you don't have a support system. You don't have a meeting to go to. You don't have a therapist. You don't have healthy fellowship around you. And if you do make it back up and you just tread along with a weak recovery program, when something happens, you relapse, it's a big dip. So that's usually what I call a relapse, is a big fall. But a lapse is just more of a slip. So people with more of a stronger recovery program, they're going to maybe have a slip. For example, if you get out of treatment, you've been in treatment for 3 months and you have a therapist, psychiatrist, and you're in some outpatient groups, and all of a sudden maybe you have a family member pass away and it's so stressful, you were close to this family member and you've been sober for 3 months, and all of a sudden you go to the liquor store, get a bottle of wine, and all of a sudden you're like, wow, what did I just do? Because you have a stronger recovery program, you're going to call your therapist, you're going to call your sponsor if you have one, you're going to go to a meeting, you're going to go to a group therapy, and then that becomes a dip rather than a major fall, and you get back on track. And so the likelihood of a lapse is possible. Doesn't mean you have to have one. I know people that have done it and never relapse or lapse ever again. But I do believe the strength of one's recovery program will determine if someone's going to have a major fall or just a slip.
Okay, thank you. When it comes to being in a recovery program, what does it take from the addict for to be successful in a recovery program?
Well, I do talk about three critical factors that I believe that if people are high on every one of those, they will be successful for the rest of their lives. And I talk about number one being honesty. Honesty with themselves or other is the most critical element, because when we're not honest, we harbor secrets. And when we harbor secrets, they turn into resentment. And resentments almost always point back at yourself, no matter what has happened. You could have been traumatized or abused as a 5-year-old, but the unhealthiness part is we will hold resentments towards ourselves. And so being honest is critically important. I talk about other factors. But another thing I would just want to clarify is that sometimes people think that it just takes pure willpower, that if you really want to quit, you can just stop. If you're depressed, think positive. If you're anxious, stay calm. If you drink a lot of alcohol, stop buying alcohol. And it willpower to me, and this is just a loose percentage, but I think willpower is just 15% of it because of all the other things that you need. Because to me, willpower of just stopping alone without adding anything else is what we call white knuckling it. And while you can only white knuckle, I look at someone holding on to a chin-up bar. You can only hold on for so long without any type of support. And so, sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Okay.
But can you take me back? I was talking about white knuckling it and those factors that are critically important. Willpower is only 15% of it, is because that's important and critical. But it's not the only. People do think that willpower, and maybe there are people out there that can say, I willpowered it and great for you, but you represent, and if you're being honest about it, you are representing a small outlier of people. The 99% of people out there need support, fellowship, guidance, coaching, accountability, and all those other factors.
How, in your practice with your patients, without revealing too much, can you tell as a psychologist? Can you tell as a psychologist if your patient is an active user and therefore mixing their psychiatry meds with substances? And like
Well,
how would that, how much, if any, would that take away from the effectiveness of the psychiatric meds?
I mean, you're talking about being honest, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is yes, we think as clinicians, we're not magicians. We're not psychics. Are we sensitive? Can we tell certain things? Yes. General population, does a therapist or a medical doctor have a little bit more of a sensitivity of things than other people that aren't trained? Yes, for sure. But are we, like I said, are we fortune tellers and psychics? No. I've had plenty of people who have probably come into session and probably weren't truthful and honest about if they used or not, or if they're cutting on themselves, or if they skip taking medications. So many times, yeah. And what I always tell people is challenge them. Like, for example, in the recovery arena, I don't argue if someone's an addict or dependent on a substance. I don't argue if someone needs to take their medication or not. What I tell them immediately to take out that power struggle is say, hey, I'm not going to argue with you whether or not you are or aren't. What I want to do is I want to give you options and a preview of what another life can look like, right? And it's going to take for you to want to be honest if you want that change. I said, that lifestyle that you came in here with is waiting for you when you leave here. And I tell them, I can't promise you that the people in your system are going to support that lifestyle, but I just want to give you options and tools to see what another life can look like. And so that really takes that away, and it puts the responsibility on them. Because if it becomes a game, whether or not they go in treatment, well, they're trying to prove to me I'm an addict and I'm going to show them not, or I'm going to show them that I don't need to take my meds for my mania, and I'm going to show them that I can stay mindful and calm. And that's where being open to direction is a critically element, with the humility that my way hasn't been working. And so that's what I try to do when I work with families and people, not only coming from a caring and empathic place, I also work on not making it a tug of war, right? And so, but anyway, that's where that comes from.
Thank you, Dr. Brian. I want to talk about secrets. In rehab, they say you're only as sick as your secrets. I feel like with an addiction, whether people know it or not, whether your family knows you're in an active addiction or not, you're hiding essentially from yourself, from who you could be, from who you want to be. And I'm dealing with that right now, but I also have an aunt who is currently on the streets, addicted to fentanyl, and that is I believe when I read it, it was according to the CDC's number one killer of ages 18 to 49, which is insane to me that I never tried opiate. I feel very lucky to never have tried it because I feel like I would love the high and I would be addicted to that instead of, abusing Adderall or something. What's the first step to try to get someone who's on the street to even listen to the family to like, for, let's say for example, an intervention. Like how is that a part of the crisis process? Oh, okay. So tell us about
If
that.
I may ask you, how long has your aunt been on the streets?
Going on 10 years.
10 years. Okay. And we're talking on the streets,
Yeah,
in the
I'm talking
park, under the
in the park,
freeway.
under the freeway, stealing, staying in random houses for
Okay.
like a couple of days.
Okay. But is anyone out there, do you know, whether it be family members providing something for her, like even if it's like a
Yes.
little, okay.
Yes. She has a boyfriend that together they're codependent with their addiction. And I guess he has like rights to a house. So they stay there, but like it's not kept.
Okay.
It's not taken care of. She lost maybe four of her front teeth. She's
Okay.
extremely thin and she looks like a hollow
Person.
version of who she used to be.
Got it. Now, is there anybody in touch with her? Does she have any family or kids or?
We're there for her. She has kids. She has a son. And we look after him as a family. He's at that age where he knows his mom is sick. That's what we call it. That's what because we don't know how to go about this. We don't know how to break it to him that his mother is an active fentanyl addict. I don't even
Okay.
know if he knows what that means.
How old is he?
He's gonna be 13 in
Got it,
December.
got it, got it. Okay.
So he's very observant. He's very, very smart. And I know he's overheard things he probably shouldn't have heard.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping too, is number one, if I would say for the 13-year-old, and I'm glad you're there with him and your family, is don't underestimate their insight, right? 13, even as young as 8, 7, you'd be amazed of how much they know or pick up. So they may not know how to express it, but just make sure also he gets help. I don't know if he's in some type of therapy, because sometimes we assume that
Yeah.
someone's fine because, oh my God, they're doing well in school, they have friends, they're gaming, they're laughing. And that's where that he's just probably maybe really good at pushing that down, because
Yeah.
that's hard, knowing that your mom is out in the streets or not in your life and an addict. And I don't know
And
if he has
she
a.
comes by once a year on Christmas, and his birthday is the day before. Well, sometimes she'll try to make both days, but like it's a hassle to get her to Christmas. So that's when we all see her once a year is on Christmas. And we're like, we hope and pray she makes it every year. So like this year, I don't even know if she's coming because I don't know if she'll be alive.
Yeah. Well, so there you go. You have someone who's facilitating that, and it's tough because the longer she stays in this state of being, the harder it is. But I also don't, on that same note, tell people never to give up hope. I've seen people homeless for years and decades and finally have a change of life path. That could be for various reasons. Maybe they suffer a medical crisis. Maybe this guy leaves her and she doesn't want to be alone, to maybe she has a spiritual awakening of some sort. So I never give up hope. But what I do is essentially the model for me is we have to put someone in a level of desperation where now they have a choice, where accepting help is the only thing that the family will support. And that's why I was asking that sometimes people are homeless, but yet you have that family that will visit them, or they will connect with them on some level. Is that we have to understand what are the leverages. And right now, the leverage that she has someone who's providing for her and so forth. And so you just have to live your life and set those boundaries and limits, and you can still plant the seeds that we love and care about you. We just can't be a part of this lifestyle that you're living. And when you plant those seeds, and I've had it before, I've had it where people are homeless or they're out and about and not getting help, and family members will send texts saying, "We love and care about you. When you're ready to get help, we'll be here for it." And it's that collection of seed planting that hopefully opens up at the right time when they have this. They're stuck in this point of whether or not having a change of life. And being homeless is very exhausting. That lifestyle is very, very exhausting. Having to find a way to get your next high. Where am I going to get my next meal every time you wake up? Am I cold? Am I hot? Am I going to get mugged? Am I going to get assaulted? And it's an exhausting, exhausting lifestyle. We sometimes think people that were homeless, like, oh my God, they know they figured it out and stuff. And many times they'd rather be anywhere else but there, but that might be their only option, and it's an exhausting lifestyle. And so sometimes the best phrases anyone can ever say to get help is, "I'm done." Not done living, but just done with this lifestyle. And she knows she has a son out there, and maybe one day. And so you can still plant those seeds. He can, but until she's ready to get help and change, that you have to be strong with saying, "We cannot participate in that lifestyle."
That's where we're at with her. She has, this has been an ongoing issue since I was 8 years old, so 21 years, almost 22 years. Her addiction has caused her to be in institutions. That's where they say it leads you, is jails, institutions, and death. So let me get off my questions here. I want to talk about treatment really quick and what that looks like today. Back when I was getting treatment, I had 30 days of inpatient rehabilitation. That included a detox phase. After that, I was an outpatient, and they called it 90-90, like 90.
90 days.
Yes, 90 meetings in 90
90
days.
days, yes.
Yeah. And then there was a basic outpatient continuum of another 3 months. Do you think that treatment is effective for today? Is
Which
there
one? The 90 and 90?
the 30-day in program, the 12 steps, and the 90-90?
Well, there's not, what I want to say is that there's no one correct way to recover from something, right? And like your family, there are some spiritual beliefs, religious beliefs, and programs within certain cultures that can be very effective, right? And so I never rule out other modalities or options. I do believe, though, that depending on the level of the person's struggle, that there are some characteristics that are critically important when someone is struggling at like a crisis level. For example, a great deal of structure is important where like a treatment facility can provide structure, meaning organization to a day where they're in groups, they're in therapy sessions, they have activities, they're eating consistently, and if they need medication. So structure is critically important, and a great deal of accountability. Accountability are these entities where they're going to hold them accountable. And that's why a treatment program can have that. You're accountable to your therapist, your psychiatrist, your peers, your family, your house members. And so those are some elements and attributes that are critically important as someone stabilizes. And I do believe there is a period of time, I call it phase one of the recovery process, where it's about 30 to 90 days, where it's critically important that the person who's struggling has a great deal of structure and routine, is because usually things in their environment is what makes them stray from staying on course, whether it be a person, a place, a situation, a substance, and so forth. And so the first 30 to 90 days is the initial healing process. Some people may need medications because they're hallucinating. They may need some medications because they're manic. They haven't been sleeping or eating. And so that 30 to 90 day window, I do believe, is critical when someone's struggling to that level of degree. Now, is 12-step meetings the answer? No. Is it the answer for some people? Yes. And so there's other different approaches, but I do, because what does a 12-step program provide? A level of structure and accountability. And so, but you can, there's flexibility in that. But like I said, attributes like being honest, having structure, accountability, being open to direction, right, are all critical elements that I believe that gets people on the course for developing a strong recovery program.
Nice. When people come to you for treatment, do you provide a plan from start to finish?
I can. It all depends
I
again.
don't think there's necessarily a finish when it comes to
Okay. Yeah.
recovering.
But when it's appropriate, you of course would like the client to share in that process of understanding what they want. There are cases where the person isn't at that level, when they're of a high level of acuity, that they aren't optimal of making those decisions and choices. And we're hoping within that.
How do you approach people who are resistant to treatment?
Well, and that's the whole premise of my book, is how do we help those people? And my strategy is when they're completely resistant, we've tried everything, is we have to come together, the other family members, and create a plan where we put the person in a place or a situation where accepting help is the only option left on the table if they're willing to get support. Most people, that's why I'm saying, is there's what we call leverages. And I said earlier, sometimes I can count on my one hand the adults that have enough finances that they can support themselves. And that's very rare. Most people that have come to a level of where they require treatment, they don't have many resources. They lost their car. They drained their bank. They've drained their bank account. They maxed out their credit cards because of their struggle. And so you have leverage. And so when you get someone resisting, we don't tell them that you need to get help. You need to stop drinking. What we tell them is, hey, we're here for you. When you're ready to get help, we're going to support you. And by identifying what those leverages are. And so it's a lot of what I do is taking out the power struggle, giving the person the element of choice who's struggling, and be very clear what you and the family are willing to be a part of and participate in, what they're not.
Okay. Leveraging like resources and stuff like that.
And it's not, I don't want your listeners to think that we're holding a carrot over your head. Well, you get help, and here's your lunch money. No,
Well,
it's
here,
just
the way
it's
I see it is like you get to have your son back. Not that we're holding him from you, from me to my aunt. Not that we're holding him from her, but that's something you get to experience now that
Exactly.
you would be in recovery. And that we've even offered her and her boyfriend help, like together. But it's just so strong. Last Christmas, they were both in the living room, like smoking it, like in the
Yeah.
house, and like
Whose house?
my mother's house for Christmas.
Okay. Well, that's a problem, right? Who?
It's definitely a problem.
Her and her
My mother.
boyfriend?
Yeah, my mother is a retired federal officer, so the dynamics in the family, it's very, the power dynamics is very to have law enforcement in your family, a federal officer, and a fentanyl addict using in your home.
That's such
That
an extreme.
it's tricky and it's tough and it's so upside down.
Yeah. Well, that's what I would look at I would look at that family dynamic is how is that possible? How is that okay? And obviously I know you laugh about it because it's true. It's just so like, oh my gosh. But that's why I would look at the family dynamic. There's that three C's that we talk about with families. You didn't cause it, you can't cure it, you can't control it, but you've perpetuated or enabled it in some form or fashion.
I will say, I will call out the family. We enable her.
Yeah. And so enabling,
Enable her.
yeah. And that's another word I clarify too, because enabling comes from a place of love, and that's what you're trying to do. We don't mean intentional harm, but it perpetuates the problem. You know, for your aunt to get to the point where this is okay to smoke fentanyl in your home, there is a very logistical family problem with that. And so I know she's sick, but for her to believe that that's okay. And so for her, in her mind, in her unwell mind, is, well, hey, what do I have to quit? I can come smoke and hang out with my family for Christmas and still get high. And so where's the motivation to get help? So what that does, it's limited her, put her in a situation where she is making a decision or motivation to get help.
And I pray that day comes. Like we've been, it's been a roller coaster with her. For we think she's, she's been to prison, and when she got out of prison, we thought that the justice system, did well and reformed her while she spent a decade in prison. But she got out, and this, I don't know if it was shame going to prison and then coming back and having to face the family. I don't know if the shame was too heavy for that, but there's something that she can't get over, and I think there's something that she can't face. I think she has a lot of guilt for what she did.
Could be, and that's what she has to work on.
I think she's living with that. Yeah, so when at what point, like, do you think counseling and talk therapy helps with addiction? Because me personally, in my experience, I don't think it ever helped me. I think it only exacerbated my addiction and just like my frustrations with recovery. I hate talk therapy. I think a big reason why people don't want to get help or want to go to rehab is they're gonna have to talk about things.
Like I said, there are other alternative ways. I believe, though, critically important, though, is in an intimate, which means a close relationship. You can have an intimate relationship with a child, a therapist, a coach, a parent, a romantic partner. It's just a close connection, and communication or dialogue is critically important. And because I do believe that if I was to choose whether or not, now, is it going to be one-on-one talk or is it a group? Can it be some other form or fashion of communication? Definitely willing to explore that. Sometimes people will talk about music and or do through action, but I do believe a level of connection and communication is critically important. Is that going to be in a group setting? Not necessarily. Is that, and it all depends, but I believe a lot of times when we harbor a lot of these traumas or these belief systems in our head, it's hard. And that's why we turn to substances sometimes to kind of quiet down those voices, so to speak. And I do believe think there's a good thing when we connect with people through communication. It's therapeutic. It gets out of our head, and we're also open to feedback from people. And because so I know talk therapy is very uncomfortable, and for me, my mindset is if it's uncomfortable in a healthy way, it's probably good for you, right? And so that's one of the things when we're in a healthier place, if something's uncomfortable, move towards it, not away from it. And I believe we've created this culture currently where discomfort is so bad. And it's not. It's your body's response to something when we're healthy, in a healthier place. Obviously, if you're uncomfortable because you use so much fentanyl, then that's obviously not a good, accurate radar system, but trust its data, its information, if you're angry or sad. But we have this culture where if you have any slight element of anxiety, get rid of it, move away from it, stop whatever you're doing, flee, or fear. And it's information and it's data. And so talk therapy is very common and it's uncomfortable. Trust me, I would say that 9 out of 10 people that come to therapy or come to treatment, they don't want to do talk therapy. They don't want to talk about it. Of course not. It's just that it's an important process, I believe. Connecting with someone else and other people through dialogue or communication is a critical component of the healing process.
Thank you, Dr. Brian. I want to continue on with the talk of treatment and therapy. I've started to see a trend out there. I visited my primary care doctor, and his office is in a suite of other different types of doctors. And I've seen ads for ketamine treatment. Now, ketamine to me is a drug that I did in college. I snorted it. And I hallucinated, and it was something I did at a party. And now, fast forward 10, 13 years later, it's being used for treatment of depression, PTSD. And my thing is, I watched the whole legalization of marijuana happen because we called it medical marijuana. We classified it as something medical, but once federal legalization, not federal legalization, but like once, because I live in Arizona, once it got legalized here, it was almost like that designation didn't even matter anymore, like whether it was medical or not. It's like, oh, we're here, we've got it legalized. That medical labeled, it doesn't really matter anymore. I kind of am seeing that same like trend with ketamine. Right now it's medical. It's being branded as medical. How do you feel about that when it's a drug that people use?
I don't rule out anything, right, as a potential option. As you know, they are still doing psilocybin or mushrooms and hallucinogenics for treatment of mental health conditions. So I don't rule out anything because there are a lot of alternatives for being a part of a treatment approach. And ketamine has been used for the treatment of depression. But of course, you want to work with a professional who's trained and certified in that level of treatment. What we find a lot is people hear about something and then they try to work on their own, like microdosing of hallucinogens. And you get all these people become acting like scientists and so forth because they heard, well, microdosing works, and they're doing it on their own, and it's making things worse. And so definitely there are other options out there, but definitely work with a professional. But I'm open to some degree certain things. And just because something's a nat like, for example, one of the things I have, just because something's natural doesn't mean that it's also good. I get that argument a lot. Well, marijuana is natural, grows in the ground, and so forth. I said, well, yeah. But so are coke so is cocoa leaves and to make cocaine, And so just because something's natural doesn't mean it is healthy. And just because something is a medicine doesn't also mean that it's unhealthy. And so it all depends on working with a professional. But ketamine has been shown to work very effectively with people with pretty resistant depression. Is it for everybody? I know that was the big issue with the Matthew Perry passing,
Yes.
and from friends, and how much was he using, and so forth. Was he overprescribed? We don't know. At least I don't the details. But that's why there has to take some level of diligence and honesty on the part of the client.
Yeah, I can see because as an addict, I've exploited how much medicine I'm asking for when it comes to like things like narcotics. Because like I know my doctor won't say no, and I can totally see like addicts like being like, oh, I want to get high off ketamine. Let me go to one of these ketamine centers. Let me go to ketamine center shopping, because I don't see these being. Oh, I don't see any type of like heavy regulation going on right now currently on it. It's kind of like, can I really go pay a copay or pay a fee and get ketamine, because that's what it feels like right now.
Yeah. So,
And I think that could be dangerous a little bit to people in recovery, to where they think like I can go get ketamine and treat my depression and still
got it.
be sober.
Exactly. And there's, like I said, there's not one way to do it. There's exceptions for certain things. But my point being is, if you present with certain risk factors, that's a mental health condition, or maybe a history of substance abuse or family history, then there's certain risk factors that make you more vulnerable to something not good happening. Because, I work in recovery, and I'm not against alcohol, I'm not against opiates, I'm not against marijuana, because there's some people that can engage in those and not be a problem, right? Some people can smoke marijuana for pain, for cancer, or sleep, and not get dependent and use the prescribed amount. There's some people who can take, who can drink wine with a nice seafood dinner and not become dependent on it. But when you have presenting risk factors, such as, like I said, a mental health condition or a substance abuse history or family history, then those type of mind-altering substance can be problematic, or you increase the risk factor if it's not mindfully and diligently cared for and supervised.
Okay, Dr. Brian, my
Yeah.
last question here is, what would you say to someone who wants to get a recovery but is just scared to make that first move?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great question to end with your last question. Is one thing I like to tell family members or people struggling is just have hope, right? It's because the process of getting help really does work. The recovery process really does. I do believe it really is. And it's never too late to start. It's never too late to reset. I've had people in their 60s finally get sober after decades. I've had people who were homeless, like your aunt, or had experienced severe traumas in their life, be able to start a new chapter in their life. And it all takes this willingness to say, I'm done and I want to try something new. And we have to have a trust in a process, especially when there's people around us who are willing to support us. A lot of times we're fighting against the same people who are on our side. And so I just want to tell all those people out there that are struggling, you can enjoy life. You can have a very fulfilling life. And as long as we accept that, hey, this is my thing, I think we open the doors for making those changes. But it's never too late to reset. Nothing you've ever been through or you've done or something done to you ever defines who you are. No diagnosis, no substance abuse ever defines who you are. We want to make those things a footnote in part of your life and create this new chapter. So that would be my biggest message to people out there.
Thank you, Dr. Brian. We appreciate it. We appreciate you coming on the show, sharing your insight and your knowledge and your
Thank you.
advice. Thank you for coming on again. And thank you to your coordinators that helped facilitate this.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.